session number 11202, reel 10.
Mr. Rogers, reel 11. Other than the flies, Mr. Rogers, what were the sanitary conditions under which you were living?
Well, they weren't too bad because our lines of communications weren't long there, and there was boxes laid out away from the battalion, open spaces where we could go to do our business. And failing that, if we were moving about, we always carried a shovel, and we just run off into the desert and dug a hole and buried it. So, as far as the troops were concerned, they were hygienic enough, but it was the place itself that was ridden with these flies, and we couldn't do much about it.
What was the health of yourself and the men like?
Well, they up to then they started to suffer later on, but up to then the health of the troops were all right, other than sandfly fever, dysentery, where you used to get a lot of that, and that, of course, the flies caused that, and sores. If you had a sore, it never seemed to mend. I never had any deadly sores, but we used to call them deadly sores. You see, if you had this sore, the flies would never off them, and that used to give a lot of trouble as well.
Were the rations good?
Well, you forget about those things. But at Alamein, we were getting cooked for, so we would be all right in that particular area. We would be getting our food all right.
And in this position in the southern end of the line, were you getting mail regularly?
Yes. The aunt pier, they call it, the mail used to come out, and we got that fairly regular. And as I said, the colour sergeant was out, and I actually paid the battalion out in the absence of the colour sergeant one time with an officer, and some of them were sent on leave. Some of the men were sent on leave from Alamein. So the conditions, other than the flies and that, and the bombing, of course, you were under observation all the time, and if you're moving about, you got shelled, and that was it.
Was the morale of the men good? They weren't moaning more than usual, were they?
Well, when we first went into the Alamein line, I think the morale was very bad. I know mine was, because I'd been up there to Gazala, all the battles I'd been in, we'd been defeated, we'd lost, and we're getting right down there, and there we were with it back to practically the Nile, and I just said to myself, well, where are we going from here? You know, if Rommel had put an attack in and it getting round us then, well. We just had nowhere to go, so the morale of myself, I was depressed, and I just consoled and said, well, I don't think I'm ever going to see home again. And that was running through my mind all the time. Then, until things started brightening up, we started to get messages that they weren't going to put any attacks in unless we had the stuff to do the job with.
How did these messages come to you?
They come through what they would call the grapevine, you know, officers and telling the men and that kind of thing. And then just before the attack, Montgomery himself used to print a sheet, and every man got one of these sheets, and he told you what was going to happen. Before, we never knew what was happening. And we used to, our biggest thing was, password was, whose side are you on? We never knew whose side we were on, because we never knew what was happening. It was just a matter of going out and whatever happened, it happened, and do the job.
Did you receive any pep talks from high-ranking officers at all, personally? Were you involved in them?
No, I can't remember of any. I can tell you one, when we got back, started form again, the troops used to be telling the stories of how kind the Germans had been to them, because when they got took prisoner of war, the Germans were giving them water and the polony. They used to carry a bit of polony in their kit, and the bread and polony, and the lads were talking and spreading it round that the Germans, they were wondering why they were fighting, really, because the Germans had been so kind to them.
These were the men that had actually
been taken prisoner of war and escaped, yeah. Mm-hmm. So we got a pep talk about that, and they told them that although the Germans had been kind to them, they were the same Germans that were bombing Coventry and London at home, you see, and they had to stop this talk of how nice Rommel's troops were.
Did this come from officers?
The officers, they told us. But I can't remember offhand of any real pep talks. I can remember that they told us that we were going to put in an attack. And remember the word of it was we were put on an alert, and it was going to be called Chicken. And for some reason or another, we had to be the first. When you looked out from the towards the enemy, from the where our position we were in, there was two big rocks, and they made a kind of a gateway, and that was our front, and we had to go through this gateway. This was from a sergeant, and he primed us with this, and we were going to be the first truck through, and then we had to disperse, and some right and some left, for the infantry for to come through and follow us through. But we had to be the first truck for some reason. I don't know why. But the officer that had to go with us was getting ready in his slit trench. They were fairly big, the officer's slit trenches, because he got a fatigue party, you know, and he had steps down to them and that kind of thing. So they were fairly roomy, and he was getting ready one particular day, and he's putting his revolver into his holster, and it went off, and he shot himself in the toe. So it was my job, before he went away, I had to make sure that there was no what we call technical instruments left the battalion. So if an officer got knocked out or anything like that, it was me that was on the ambulance and taking his binoculars off, and his revolver, and his compass.
Did you call his name?
Not for sure, but I think it was named something like Hazard. He was a second lieutenant, I think. But I couldn't. There was a Z in his name, something like Hazard or like that. Anyway, we got him on the truck, and we got him away, and I got his revolver off him as well, because he wasn't very safe with that, so we took that off him, and it never come off. We didn't have to do this attack. I think it had only been set about maybe for to confuse some people on the other side, but it never happened, and we just carried on with our usual duties after that. And then comes the word that we were moving out, but I hadn't to move out. I had to stop there with the sergeant major and about 12 blokes, and the battalion was moving out up to the, I think it was the north, and they had to go up there, and we had to stay behind. And because we were under observation, we had to light fires, jump about, run from one place to another. And we weren't getting shelled then, but we were occasionally getting shelled. And we had to do all this kind, shake blankets and light fires and do all this kind of thing. And until night time, and then a truck come for us and caught up to us, and we caught up to the battalion.
And what time, what date of the year this was?
Well, this was just before the attack on the 23rd of October. It was when they put the attack in, yeah. And maybe this rumour about the chicken thing that was going to happen, maybe it was to make the Germans think there was going to be an attack put into that side. I don't know, but we just travelled up. And I caught up with, I think I was with the quartermaster then, I think. And we moved up through the Alamein line, but somebody had already gone up before us. You know, I think with the Australians and other people, New Zealanders had probably broken through. And I can remember just moving up through the night very, very slowly under that Macadam Road that I had built up there, and you could see the flashes of the guns as you were moving up, and then you could hear them, you know, and it was terrific. It was a great big line of them, and we moved right through these artillery guns firing, and we, from then on, it was just moving on all the way, you know, carrying up. I can't remember the.
Recall the attack which the brigade made through the lines in the north.
No, it didn't affect me. If the brigade did put an attack in, I wasn't involved in it. No, I was just following on with this with this store truck. You see.
So that your duties in effect would carry you ultimately through the line and then up the road.
Yes, just followed the line of advance all the way, and which we did.
What's your memories after that?
Well, the memories of that were just moving through. When first light came, they were just moving up this road. There was trucks blown up, dead bodies, both British and New Zealand, you know, the Allies and the Germans. All just lying on either side of the road. Nothing had could be done about them because they were moving back and we were moving forward, and it just went on like that all the time. But troops followed on behind us, pioneered and different. We tidied the area up, but it wasn't a pretty sight. It wasn't a pretty sight at all. But
what happened next?
Well, from then on, it was just moving up all the way. I was in every place from Alamein up to Tripoli, Tunisia, every town, Homs, Sirte, all these places. But it wasn't as easy as that. We moved up. Sometimes we were held up, and perhaps the battalion went into action. I don't know. But I can remember when we got as far as, well, start with Merton Matru first. When we got to Merton Matru again, after we broke through, there was about eight of us or more, might have been. The officers was John Willie Robinson and Mad Robbo, I have to call him Mad Robert because I didn't know he was on the
air.
He must have had, because he said he was going to the old battle area, Murder Matru. So we went with him. And when we got there, I went to look for my position, because my haversack and all my letters, and I've still got some of them there now. I had to leave them behind. And I found my position, and I found my overcoat and all these things. But they'd found Adam Wakenshaw's, and he hadn't been buried. And none of the dead had been buried in that area. They were still lying there, and would be good eight or ten weeks after, and they were still lying there. Anyway, Adam Wakenshaw was buried, but I wasn't there with them when they buried him. But there was a photograph taken of the people that were there at the time, because I was found my position, and I was with a sergeant from Sunderland here, and the dead were lying about all over the place. And he went up to one of them, and he lying there with his feet out and his jack boots, and he just gave the jack boot a kick, and he says, "Come on, you bugger, it's Three Valley." And I thought that was a little bit hard. I said, "Well, I'm not going to bury them." He said, "We haven't got time." He said,
"He's been in a pretty bad state."
He was, yes, and the fingernails seemed to be, to me, that hit me, were very long, and his hair was long, this particular one, and they didn't seem as if they'd been, the Arabs used to follow us around, you know, and loot all these things, but it didn't seem as if anyone had been back to that area since the battle. And he must have been, Rommel must have been in such a hurry that they left everything and not even bothered to bury, and then perhaps forgot about them after. But Adam Wakenshaw was found, and there was an extracted shell lying across his chest, and this was from the lads that buried him, you know, and the officers that were there, and they buried him, and they put a cross up for him. And just as I was coming back, there was somebody taking a photograph, so they had a photograph somewhere of these people that buried him.
From then
on, as far as I can remember, we went we were going on all the time. We were just moving it every chance we got. He was on the run, and we were glad about that. And we got up to Benghazi, just there, and we seemed to have a fairly long spell of maybe about a day or 2 days there. But the battalion started to go down with yellow jaundice, and the reason was, I think, that when you were out of the battle area then, so we weren't digging in, and we were lying down just on the sand, and the rats used to eat your blankets. When you lay on the sand like that, the rats used to come and eat your blankets, and the saliva when you're asleep. I've many a time knocked a rat that's been on my face, and it's been taking the saliva off me mouth. I've knocked it away. And I think they must have started this yellow jaundice. And I can remember, I keep going back to this Mad Robbo, where he comes to me one day, and he stopped me walking across the desert, and he said, he pulled his eyes down. He said, "What do you think, Roger?" And I had a look. I said, "M.O., because his eyes were yellow. The white of his eyes were both yellow. I said, M.O. So we would lose him then for a while. He would, I can't remember catching up to him again. But anyway, there was a lot of the battalion went down at Benghazi with the yellow jaundice. But I never got it myself. I never had it. The only thing I ever had was scabies in there, and I think it was handling some of the kits, and you used to get into your hands.
Where did you go after that?
Benghazi, we moved further up, and we were coming then into where the green grass was grown and the trees were grown, and it was places like Derna, you know, which was grand for us. We'd been in the sand all the time, and sandstorms we'd had to put up with, and the camsines, the wind, you know, blowing the sand in. You know, you would be yellowed, wouldn't be with the yellowed jaundice, but you would be yellow who could withstand some of the days. It used to be terrible. So we moved on then, and I think the next I can recollect was when they made a stand at Manorth. Went through Derna and all these cultivated places. Tripoli, we were able to, the Highland Div had taken Tripoli and we followed them in, so we were able to go to the cathedral for mass there with the padre. I can remember that. We used to be able to swim in the beaches because you weren't always in action, you know, in the behind the land, and I think I must have swam in every beach from the Alexandria up to Tripoli.
What are your recollections of Marath and your particular involvement there?
Well, when I went into hospital with scabies again, and it was a New Zealand hospital, and I knew we were moving up to Marath. We were just outside of Marath, and I knew we were moving up to Marath, and we were going into action. And it was only for about a couple of days or so. And in Cyprus, when I had these scabies, they set them with the ointment. But when I went into this New Zealand hospital, they just put you in a bath. They said, "We'll get rid of them for you," and they just put you in the bath because you used to get around where your private parts as well. And they just got a scrubbing brush and they scrubbed all these things off your hand and off your body, and until they were red raw and bleeding, and then they just put something on it, and about a couple of days, and then I got rid of them. It was grand treatment there. A bit rough, but they soon got rid of them. So I had to leave there, and I knew where the battalion was and I knew where they were going, and I got put on an ambulance. And they were taking us back to a base camp somewhere, you see. And I said to the driver, "Will you drop me off? Because I don't want to go down there." I said, "I'm going to join my battalion. I know where it is." He said, "I'm not allowed." I said, "Well, if we can get to the bend, slow down. You're not allowed, but I'm getting off." So he slowed down at the bend, and I dropped off. And I was going to hitchhike back to the battalion, and on the side of the road, and I had an orange in my pouch, and I thought I would eat this orange, and I was sitting on the side of the road, and I had this orange half peeled, and I seen a truck coming up, so I stood and asked them for a lift, waving my hand, you know, and I pulled up, and there was a flag on the front of the car. It was one of the, I guess what type of car it was, but there was a flag on the front of it, and it must have been the divisional commander. So if you've ever tried to salute a divisional commander with the orange in your hand, you'll just know exactly how I felt. And he said, "Where are you going?" And I told him, I said, "I want to make my way to the 9th Battalion." He said, "Do you know where they are?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "They're moving up into Marath," and he said, "Well, get in and I'll give you a lift up." So he gave us a lift up to divisional headquarters, and when he got there, he must have went on the phone himself and phoned the battalion, and I had to wait for the truck coming down. But it wasn't just ordinary truck, ordinary driver, it was an officer that brought the truck down. He said, when he saw me, he got the shock of his life. He says, "Good Lord," he said, "up there," he says, "divisional commander has been on the phone." He said, "They're all running around like city fleas around there." He said, "It's chaos up there." And he said, it's for to come down to collect you. He says, I thought I was coming down to collect somebody important. And he asked me how it all happened, and I told him. I said, but sir, I didn't know I was going to stop the divisional commander for the lift. And he put it on the truck, and we moved up, and we moved up into the mouth line. And it wasn't easy when we got there, because they he was up in the hills, and he was looking down at us all the time, so every movement was seen. So we were able to unload the, when we moved out, unload the truck, and we were getting shelled. And one particular time, the lad, the driver that was helping me, he said, I think they're getting a little bit too close to the shelled. I said, oh, they're all right, man, they're miled up. But all of a sudden, you seem to know that this one is going to come too near. And I said, right, this is it. And we made a dive into a hole. And I think we'd only, we paced it out. We're about 15 yards from where we'd been, great big crater.
You were with the quartermaster stores?
Yes, then.
Behind the leading.
Yes,
And what of the attack? Did you get involved in any way?
I didn't get involved, because they gave me a job, and it was they come for me and they said they want you to be liaison officer. And I said, well, what does that mean, and what have I got to do? He said, well, you've got to go to the brigadier and with a 1500 weight truck and take the messages from the brigadier to the battalion. You've got to just stay with the brigadier, and when he wants you, he'll come for you. So the lads went into Marath, and I went down to the brigadier, which was miles behind the line, like, you know. And we were right next to a great big gun that was firing from there, and I think that's why I'm a little bit deaf now, because I couldn't hear the gun in the end. It was just a crack, you know, and went off. And he come out and he said, the battalion haven't got any rations. And they're complaining they haven't got any rations. So I go up and see why they haven't got the rations. And they went into action, seemingly, and they were on the side of the hill, and it had rained or something, and the sand had, they would make a way for the tanks to get through. And the sand had churned up the tanks, and the tanks got stuck, and they just got bombed to hell all the time. They were on the side of the streets, and they couldn't even get the rations through. So I went and I found the QM, and I told him, and he said, we're trying to get through, we're going to get through. I said, well, I might be able to get through. I said, I've only got a 1500 weight here. And I said, if you put them on here, I'll get through. And he said, well, look, he said, yeah, it's no good. He said, we've tried. And he said, anyway, they're coming out. So he said, you'll go back and tell the brigade major that, yeah, the battalion's coming out. So I went back and I told him. And he said, well, you better go and bring them out then.